Session number 13205, reel 4.
Mr. Webster, reel 4.
As I said, I was drafted to Blythe. They had two oldest submarines there. I think they were X-14, 18, or thereabouts. One was the L-23. I can't remember the number of the other, but this L-23 beat like a bucket. I think we did leave the basin at Blythe, and we dived to not more than 30 foot. My first dive, incidentally, it was strange, but I wasn't really perturbed about it. It was a unusual experience, a new experience. I did note that there were the valves were leaking quite a bit of water, and I think the captain, remember his name, rather made it as dramatic as they could, for after all it was just a breaking in process. I didn't display any sign of panic or worried. Not even worried. Some people do. In fact, some, I've spoken to submarine sailors, they never really got over the fact of diving. I must have taken to it like a bucket of water, or perhaps I was a bit bone. Anyhow, to carry on, I completed my course. On the 19th of February, and on arrival at Dolphin, I was then drafted to Dunoon, where the fourth was a depot ship. I became a member of the spare crew. Those were the poor unfortunates that fell in for ship's duties, and they were awaiting their turn to take passage to whichever theatre of war they were going to. My submarine that took me out to the Mediterranean was submarine Tacu. The captain was a Lieutenant Commander Hopkins, I remember. We did a breaking in patrol along the Spanish coast, encountering quite a few Spanish fishing boats and diving, all in the breaking in procedure. And we arrived in Gibraltar on the 19th of February, and moored up alongside HMS Maidstone, the depot ship.
How different was the telegraphist's job in a submarine from a surface ship?
I think myself that as a telegraphist. You had a telegraphist, a leading telegraphist, and a petty officer telegraphist. The responsibilities, I think, were more. In general service, you were inclined to. Your duties were wholly and solely communications. On submarines, you had various jobs. Obviously, wireless operator was your main job, but you had, when dived, I was on the telegraphs, the Boots telegraphs, which was a pretty nerve-wracking experience, especially when we were being depth charged. Also, telegraphists were like everybody else. You mucked in. If it was paint ship, you paint ship. Supply ship, you got supplies in. During gun action, I had one job, was halfway up the gun terror hatch, passing up the ammunition. Now, in peacetime, a wireless operator wasn't allowed within 10,000 miles of a gun. So he's taking into account the hearing abilities required for communications. But that was all waved aside in submarines. Each man had to know his own job well, but he also had to know the other jobs. The only jobs that we didn't know were I was never acquainted with the stoker job, the engine room. That was just a mass of nuts and bolts to me as I passed through, and stinking of diesel oil. By God, those chaps worked hard.
Did anything happen on that patrol off the Spanish coast?
The Spanish coast, apart from seeing a few fishing boats, it was quiet. I think the breaking in patrol areas were deliberately chosen to enable a submarine to retire into that area and knock the crew into shape, get used to the routine. You would never send a green submarine out on a patrol. You always give them one breaking in patrol, and from that the captain and officers particularly could assess the crew. It was vitally important that these submarine commanders knew their crew. They knew every individual man, and probably they knew how every individual man felt, what his qualities were. That was all in aid of preserving the boat. No good going to sea with a crowd of yobs and you don't know what their capabilities are.
So you said you arrived at Maidstone in Gibraltar.
That's right. 19th of February, 42. I remain spare crew until the 11th of September, 42.
Did that mean you went on operations?
During which time I had one big operation. I was drafted to the Clyde. She was one of our largest type submarines. So Clyde, the Olympus, was another. She was lost, unfortunately, off Malta. Our job on this occasion was conveying supplies through to Malta, which were really under siege at that time. in fact the worst part of their siege. We carried ammunition, food, torpedoes, and the one supply that really got us down, aviation spirit, to supply the few aircraft that Malta had still flying. As a result, we had the no smoking zone. There was no smoking at all during the 18-day trip, which was done mainly dived. But of course, on occasion, we had to surface to recharge the batteries. That was when the Clyde was really vulnerable. Because after all, apart from the ammunition, the aviation spirit, a near miss, I think she would have gone up like a torch. She had one other bad effort as far as submariners are concerned. She took a heck of a time to dive up to, I'd say, surface to 30 foot would be 3 minutes. Now, 3 minutes is a long time if an aircraft is coming in at you, as opposed to the old tour that I served on later on. She could, from surface, with two lookouts and officer the watch, crash dive to 30 feet in 17 seconds. So you can see the vast time that it took the Clyde to get out. In fact, at times, they had to more or less force her down. She just really refused to go down. Anyhow, we arrived in Malta.
How was she forced down? How could she be forced down?
Well, the appliance of flooding tanks, hydroplanes hard to dive, and full ahead on electric motors, because the main engines, diesel engines, were switched off, and of course we came under electric propulsion. At times on the whether it was ever used with the Clyde, I don't know, but I have been in submarines since that we flooded queues. This was an extra flooding of queue quick diving tank that brought on an extra tonnage of water. But the moment this tank was flooded, aided by the group up on the motors and planes hard to dive, the moment Q flooded, Q was automatically vented. Otherwise she would have been positive weight and they would never have pulled her out of her dive. A submarine has to, whenever possible, achieve negative buoyancy. Or neutral buoyancy, I should say. So she's suspended in the water like a piece of waterlogged wood. Right, carry on. The 12th of September 1942, I was drafted to the...
Oh, you said you arrived in Malta. Can you describe what happened there?
Cancel that. I'll now go on to Malta. We went to the fueling jetty and discharge their aviation spirit, aviation, high octane stuff, I remember, and at various jetties we discharge our ammunition and torpedoes. And really, we skipped out of Malta as fast as we could. If I remember rightly, the unloading was done night time, and we were on our way within a very short time after we'd disembarked all our gear. With the Clyde proceeding back to Gibraltar, I was drafted inboard to the Maidstone as spare crew. Spare crew amongst submariners, it's okay, but in a theatre of war, as the Mediterranean was then, the hopes of you ever getting home, or so it seemed, were negligible. You had to get to a boat and become part of the crew so that when her stints of patrols were done, you went back to the UK. The average stint was about, I suppose the average boat got in about 14 patrols, maybe 12. At 1 a month, well, that's a fair old time to be submarining. Now then, I joined the spare crew, but on the 19th of February, 42, I was drafted to the Safari, the then P-211.
Is that the right date?
My last statement, rejoining the Safari, ignore those dates. At that time, I was spare crew on the Maidstone. I actually joined the Safari on the 12th of September 1942. And I remained with her until the 19th of March 1943. Right, I'll continue now as far as patrol work went.
Can you tell me, before you do that, something about the submarine and its captain?
Yes. The Safari was an S-class submarine. Approximate weight 1,000 ton. She had four bow caps, four, eight torpedoes, but unusual for a class, she had no stern tubes. These, I understood, were blanked off to allow the captain Bryant to have a larger caliber gun. The average S-boat was a 3-inch gun. He wanted a 4-inch or above gun in order to carry out the war in the Med with a gun, a good gun that would penetrate merchant ships. 3-inch shells, I understand, were ricocheting off, but a 4-inch, a different thing altogether, and they did the job. So he sacrificed two torpedoes, or four torpedoes, for the sake of his beloved gun, which he certainly used to good effect. Whilst on the safari, I did 6 patrols. Each one took us up into either the Adriatic or the Aegean Sea. The Adriatic run was a queer run, really, because we would zigzag up the Adriatic. We'd start off on the Yugoslavian coast. Torpedo whatever we saw, and there were very few opportunities for torpedoing. It was where Ben Bryant's gun came into its element. We did quite a few gun actions. Although these small ships, and they were only small, 500 ton or so, came down the islands and the coast, sheltered mostly by shore batteries. So the essence was to dive surface, get off as many rounds as possible before either a seaplane came over or shore batteries engage you. At that period, attack by escorts was not so regular. We knew that the nuisance raids that submarines did on small craft, including ferries, would force the Italians to bring out their escort vessels and their attack vessels, thereby using up precious oil, which was otherwise being transported to help Rommel with his aims in the desert. Of course, a submarine is very vulnerable on the surface. Especially when going to gun action. Obviously the gun layers were good, there's no doubt about it. They were the only ones to stand by the periscope after the skipper had sized the situation up and look at the target, mainly to assess the point of aim. Because once we surfaced, it was imperative to get on target as quickly as possible. And most times, these lads did do that. We also did several commando landings on the Yugoslavian coast. We did land these chaps with their canoes, but despite going to rendezvous at certain times off certain beaches, we were never successful in retrieving the lads that we'd pushed ashore. Whether they were killed on entering, we did hear fire on one occasion, or whether, having done their mission, they joined the partisans, we were never told.
Can you tell me that story again? You were telling me earlier off the record about the Italian you nearly saved from the casing.
Oh yes, yes, we were up in the Adriatic. And had attacked one of these small schooners. They were used by the Italians for quite a few duties, ammunition carrying. aviation spirit. I suppose the Aitai thought, well, it's better to get 3 500-tonners through than lose a 1,500-tonner with aviation spirit on. They were a nuisance value more than a help, I should imagine. But anyhow, we could always tell when there was aviation spirit involved, because the moment we surfaced, the Aitais, and I don't blame them, abandoned the ship straight away. On this occasion, I should imagine she was carrying normal supplies. We hit her, and she sank, and there were several survivors in the water. And Ben Bryant steered towards them in order to pick up survivors. I think from tactical point of view, the main reason, apart from the humanitarian effort, was to get either the skipper or his engineer officer or navigator for intelligence. We landed them at Malta, and of course they went into the hands of the intelligence service to find out how things stood up in the Adriatic as far as the German forces were concerned. Anyhow, we surfaced and we went towards the few survivors up there, and I spotted one, or rather, when called on the casing, I spotted one. He was quite close to the sub. And I went on the casing, slithered over, then onto the saddle tanks, one hand catching hold of the casing, the other to whip this poor unfortunate onto the casing or onto the saddle tanks and get him down below. Trying to retrieve him, I noticed he was either dead or unconscious. Anyhow, I succeeded in pulling him onto the saddle tank and was just about to prop him up onto the casing. Then I heard Ben shouting from the bridge, "Who is that stupid bee on the after casing?" Now, unknown to me, an Italian float plane had been seen, and the klaxon had sounded for the dive. I hadn't heard it, but I did hear Ben's next statement. He said, "Drop whatever you've got there and get down onto the in the bridge, you stupid bastard," he said. And I was really indignant. I dropped this poor chap, and as I slithered up the casing, I saw his body being dragged towards the stern of the safari, bearing in mind that we were grouped up for diving, which is high speed for diving. The last I saw of him was disappearing in the direction of the propellers. I felt grim about it. I got on board and nothing was said, though when I look back on it, I was a stupid bee. I must say, by not hearing and by not acting promptly,